cool industry for a cooler planet.
The low-cost, clean, renewable energy is back to the future. You know, that's what started the whole economic engine here in Holyoke over 150 years ago.
That's Jim Lavelle, manager of Holyoke Gas and Electric Power Company. He tells us how Holyoke's industrial past points the way to a greener future.
And now what we're going to do is we're going to go back into the Hadley Falls Station. I'm going to take you inside of Hadley Unit 1. We're actually going to be able to travel inside. You'll see the spinning rotor and basically as close as you possibly can get to electricity being made.
That's Calvin Ellis, also of Holyoke Gas and Electric. He'll take us on a tour of the hydroelectric plant at the South Hadley Falls.
The Connecticut River Valley from about 1820 to 1950 was one of the two or three leading places in the world for making the technologies that made things, and there's no reason why we couldn't revive that in some form again, at least in my mind.
And that's Robert Farrant, professor of regional economic development and sustainability at UMass Lowell. He tells us about machine tool manufacturing in the 19th century and the lessons it holds for us today. And we also hear about Holyoke's industrial history from Penny Martorell and Charlie Lotsbeach. That's all coming up on today's Sea Change Radio. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Welcome to the fifth episode of our Back to the Future series. Each month, we explore what we can learn from the past when we used far less fossil fuels than we do today. We're looking at practices we can adapt as we move toward a lower carbon future. In an earlier episode, we learned how rural areas of Massachusetts used water to power grist mills and sawmills in the early years of our nation's history. Today, we look at how the mighty power of the Connecticut River fueled the birth of manufacturing in Massachusetts and the country, not just in producing finished goods like paper and textiles, but also in making the machinery that drove production. The Connecticut River has always been a vital resource for the people who have lived along its banks. Early indigenous people used it for transportation, fishing, and farming, as did the early English settlers. And local merchants used the river to transport their goods. But the high falls at South Hadley presented an obstacle to transport up the river from port cities further south. So locks and canals were built to get around the falls and keep the goods moving north. Penny Martorell is the archivist at the Holyoke Public Library. She tells us what happened in 1847.
George Ewing and the Boston Associates, who had connections up in Lowell and had started water power concerns up there, turned their attention to Holyoke. And since there was a 59-foot drop in the river, it was a perfect place to start looking for a dam. So he and Boston Associates in 1858 started construction on the first wood dam.
On November 16, 1848, at 10 a.m., according to one historian, the gates were closed and the reservoir began to rise. But within hours, the dam was swept away to the famous words, "Dam gone to hell by way of Willimansett." But no matter, the builders went right back to work and made a stronger dam. That's because they wanted to erect one of the first planned industrial cities in America, right there.
The sloping land and the bend in the river made it an ideal site for a hydropower city.
Charlie Lotsbeach, park supervisor at Holyoke Heritage State Park.
They calculated how much flow and how much of a drop there was and figured they could put up 100 mills, typical of the day in 1850 or so, and build a large manufacturing city. So they came up with a plan on paper. That's why it's called one of the first planned industrial cities. Started from scratch, built a dam, started digging the canals, and invited industries to come. Parsons Paper Company was the first big industry to set up in the 1850s, right near the dam. Took about 50 years to dig the canals. So about 1900, the whole basic water power canal system infrastructure of the city was completed, and the city was reaching its peak as the largest producer of rag paper in the world, also a great textile center.
Who built the canals?
The canals were built by the Holyoke Water Power Company, which was essentially the developer and the sort of the antecedent for the for the Holyoke Gas and Electric, which took up the electrical side in the early 1900s when conversion to hydroelectric generation of electricity got underway. The Holyoke Water Power Company grew out of the early days, and the key people were, you know, the key industrialists and developers who owned the land and the water rights and sold those water rights to industries and sold the land to manufacturers who wanted to set up along the canals.
The water flowed from the upper canal, the first level canal, through the mill buildings, turning the turbines that generated the machinery for the presses and the forgener machines, they're called, to make the paper. So it was phenomenal operation. And also the water was used in the pulp process as well.
This is mills that are turning wheels. When did this become married to electricity?
Well, the Holyoke Water Power Company was involved right from the beginning. It was an evolution, a process from the South Hadley Falls to the Water Power Company. And because they were providing the energy for the mills, it was just a natural extension to extend that power out to the rest of the community as it was growing. In 1902, the gas and electric department of the municipality joined with the Holyoke Water Power Company in ownership and operation of the dam. And so Holyoke now, the city of Holyoke, is a municipal water and gas and electric powered municipality run operation.
Holyoke has benefited by having its power company owned by the city, luring industry by keeping the price of hydroelectric power down. I paid a visit to Jim Lavelle, manager of the power company, Holyoke Gas and Electric. He ushered me into his office in the beautifully renovated former bank that serves as the power company's headquarters. It features high ceilings and warm, gorgeously carved woodwork in the style of the time it was built, during Holyoke's heyday as an industrial center.
Holyoke is unique to the extent that they were the original, you know, it's the first major dam constructed in the United States and really developed a city based around water power.
Mm-hmm. And how much energy does Holyoke get from water still?
We get about 60% on average of our energy from water power, and in some years, depending on the hydrology and weather, we get maybe even up to 70% of our energy from water power.
Joining us in Jim Lavelle's office was Calvin Ellis, marketing director for Holyoke Gas and Electric. He explains how the city gets its power.
This is a map of our three-level canal system. We have over 3 miles of canals and 31 hydroelectric wheels that are located on the canal system.
How does it work?
Well, it basically works on the power of falling water. There's a 60-foot drop at the Holyoke Dam. We generate the majority of the power at our Hadley Falls unit. The water continues to cascade down the canal system. Basically, each one of these units, there's a penstock that takes the power of the falling water. It falls over a turbine, and that turbine is used to generate electricity.
A map is nice, but it's no substitute for the real thing. Calvin Ellis took me to the dam and the hydroelectric facility itself.
These are we're overlooking our hydroelectric generation units right now. These are the two largest hydroelectric generation units in our canal system. Hadley 1 was installed in the mid-1960s. Hadley 2 was installed in the mid-1980s. And together, these are approximately 60% of the power that we generate here in Holyoke.
We threaded our way past the generating units and out onto a catwalk overlooking the river and its dam. So tell us what we're looking at here.
We're out on the observation deck right now. We're looking at the Holyoke Dam and over to the South Hadley side of the river. We can also see behind you our fish elevator system. This was the first fish elevator system in the world, and it's been copied at every major hydroelectric facility today. We lift about 250,000 fish each year through these systems. They're Andromedas fish that are looking to return to the waters of their birth to spawn. We have a rubber bladder system on the top of the dam, which allows us to control the levels of water north of the dam. Today, all 5 parts of the bladder are inflated, which is limiting the flow of the rushing water over the dam.
Another way of controlling the flow of water is by means of gates, enormous metal wheels that reside in the dam's gatehouse. They look like they've been there for decades. We went into the gatehouse to see them.
Each one of these gates in succession is going to be opening to allow water to flow into the canal system from the river.
And with a high-pitched whine, the floodgates opened.
Wow.
Calvin Ellis then took me back into the Hadley Falls station.
I'm going to take you inside of Hadley Unit 1. It's actually, we're actually going to be able to travel inside. You'll see the spinning rotor and basically as close as you possibly can get to electricity being made. That is the sound of hydroelectricity being produced. We are inside of our Hadley 1 unit right now, and we are currently in operation, generating somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 megawatts of electricity.
What I saw was a very quickly spinning large cylinder.
Correct. And as that shaft turns, on one part, the falling water is turning a turbine, which turns that shaft. Above that shaft are exciters, which use the spinning power of the shaft to generate electricity.
Terrific. Thanks so much. You're listening to Episode 5 of Sea Change Radio's Back to the Future series, and we're talking about what we can learn from the industry of the past as we transition to a greener industry future. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Holyoke's Mills depended on a thriving machine tool industry that began in Springfield just a few miles south on the Connecticut River. It soon spread upriver to Holyoke itself. Bob Forent teaches sustainable economic development at UMass Lowell. A former Springfield machinist himself, he says machine tooling got started in the Connecticut River Valley because of the Springfield Armory.
The federal government, after the revolution, and once we establish a constitution and a government, look around and say, uh-oh, we have no way to make anything to defend ourselves if, in fact, the British decide they might want to come back at some point. And so Alexander Hamilton and others decide they're going to take some federal treasury money and invest in creating some kind of a manufacturing base. They search high and low around the new country and eventually actually decide they want to build an armory in what is now West Springfield, but farmers in West Springfield don't want it. And it ends up on the other side of the river in Springfield.
That was in the early 1800s.
1820, we start to have a fairly sizable, for the time, complex of not only armory workers trying to figure out how to mass-produce rifles, but a lot of other smaller shops are going to grow up in and around the armory because the armory becomes pretty good at subcontracting like we have today. Actually, it's not such a new thing. And the armory creates what I think of as a very sort of innovative model for creating the base of a big manufacturing network, almost like a spider web of little companies, the armory, and eventually larger companies grow from these smaller ones.
Bob Florence says these small machine tool operations were powered by a variety of mostly renewable energy methods. First, water.
Springfield basically was using water power from an area of the city called the Water Shops Ponds. And so if you look at old diagrams of the buildings, you see them essentially building canalways and other connecting things from where the water was to where the factories were being built.
Then other forms of power began to be used.
We're talking water power initially and then steam after that. I've also done a fair amount of research on the growth of these smaller companies in the greater Worcester area as well, and they're interestingly enough, were factory buildings that were built, fairly sizable buildings, that had a dozen or more of these little tiny shops doing all sorts of different metalworking things inside the shops, and eventually they were powered with steam and steam boilers and wood. And you had actually a pretty interesting, kind of like the first green factories in a way. You had a lot of the shops that had, for example, somebody making planing machines to make window frames. And then somebody else in the shop would actually have the wood and buy the machinery or rent the machinery and make the window frames, and the scrap wood that was cut away would then be thrown into a steam boiler of some sort that would then generate the power to run the mill. So very sort of interesting. I think it seems to me to be green manufacturing before we even thought about green manufacturing.
Because they're using biomass and recycling.
Yeah, I mean, everything was used, and it was, you know, it was water, and it was steam, and it was wood, and not just throwing the wood scraps away, but actually, you know, throwing them in the furnace. And so Worcester in particular had, by the 1830s, 1840s, Worcester had three or four of these buildings that were very prominent in the development of the Worcester manufacturing base.
But industry fell on hard times in the Connecticut River Valley. The downturn started first in Holyoke in the 1920s and culminated in a wave of arsons and plant closings in the 1960s and 70s. It was all part of a deindustrialization of the Northeast, a victim of globalization. Charlie Lotspeech of Holyoke Heritage State Park.
Then in the 1920s, you know, mills began to move south. The first big plant closings happened in the late 1920s, and the paper and textile industries pretty much shut down by the 1960s.
Did the Great Depression have something to do with that?
The Great Depression did have something to do with it. It made the situation worse, but actually the first big plant closing was during the heyday of the 1920s, a couple of years before the Great Crash, when wages were lower in the South. Industries continued to move out as a result of new types of power, steam power, and then electrical power that could be taken anywhere. And so industries did not need to be located near water power anymore. So they went to be closer to the resources and closer to cheaper labor and unions that were not as strong as they were up here in New England.
The same forces affected machine tooling, as Bob Forent explains.
After the Second World War, a lot of the larger firms that had been doing well in Greater Springfield had been locally owned and operated. Managerial groups came from Springfield or Holyoke or, you know, wherever. And there was some sort of linkage and some understanding of the importance of the community where these factories were. But post-World War II, a lot more, increasingly, these shops were bought by larger corporations, and the ones that had been small and started locally, like a Westinghouse in Springfield up on Page Boulevard, for example, Westinghouse grows, becomes a much more powerful, much more global corporation even back in the 1950s. And so a lot of the ownership changes, and the investments in skill and in the local community are less essential to the business model these characters are using than is making money. And so that's one part of the story. A second part of the story is a lot of the shops in the Connecticut River Valley are unionized during the 1930s in the big push during the New Deal to organize lots of these large industries. General Electric, Westinghouse, a lot of the big firms in Greater Springfield are unionized. American Bosch, where I worked, is unionized. And companies, while they sort of don't fight vigorously during the Second World War, the unionization, when the war ends, they really want to, in their minds, take back control over the shop floor, and that's pretty much how they look at it. And so they start doing battle with their unions, and because they're also growing, they have investment capital, and they start building new factories, particularly in the American South. And in the late 40s, early 50s, Southern governors, and I actually found a lot of this in my research, Southern governors would come to Springfield, stay in a hotel in downtown Springfield and take half-page ads out in the Springfield newspapers and say, if you want to move your shop to Mississippi or South Carolina or whichever state the governor represented, we'll build your plant for you, we'll train your workforce, we'll help you with your electricity, we'll give you tax rebates. And so this, again, which we think is a more modern phenomenon, is actually happening in the 40s and the 50s, and so this is enticing. The Bosch takes the bait and builds a sizable factory in Mississippi during the early 50s, as an example, and moves hundreds of jobs from Springfield that early. Westinghouse moves a lot of jobs to new facilities in the south and in southern Ohio based on the same model. So that's another piece of the puzzle. And then finally, by the 70s, a lot of the shops, particularly in Vermont, there were actually a lot, believe it or not, there were a lot of these shops in Springfield, Vermont back then, and a lot of the ones in Vermont are bought up by Gulf and Western, and Gulf and Western knows very little about making machinery, and the firms, when they buy them, are quite productive, but the machine tool industry is pretty cyclical. It really moves up and down based on what's going on in the rest of the economy, and when the industry started losing money post the defense spending with the Vietnam War, Gulf and Western basically decided they were not going to invest further in these companies. And meanwhile, in Japan and in South Korea and other places, there's a real push on by the governments, their governments, to build a machine tool industry. And eventually we're outcompeted technologically by particularly Japanese companies and also German companies, too.
There's still some machine tooling happening in Holyoke, even today. But Holyoke Gas and Electric's Jim Lavelle thinks machine tooling could come back strong to Holyoke, especially as the cost of fossil fuel skyrockets, crimping transportation costs and encouraging more local manufacturing. I asked Lavelle how he saw Holyoke using the historic knowledge and resources it has to transition to a new green economy.
Well, we're doing a number of things to adapt to the green economy and to even drive it in some regard. We are right now, as I mentioned, can get up to 70% of our energy from the hydroelectric assets that we own and operate. We're driving to try to get to 100% carbon-free electricity that we sell to our customer base. And we're doing that by trying to extract more hydroelectric energy from the system that is in place through efficiencies, overhauling older units so that they can use the available water more efficiently. We're also looking at other resources, such as wind. There's a mountain in our backyard here, Mount Tom, and we recently acquired 270 acres on the summit of that mountain to determine the feasibility for wind power. And we're looking to try to balance the environmental resources up there with the energy needs and the renewable energy needs of the community. So we'll be looking to try and develop wind resources. And we're looking at other renewable resources such as solar, biomass, and others as well.
Holyoke is going to be the site of a new high-performance data center serving the computing needs for some of the state's most important educational institutions.
MIT, UMass, BU, Northeastern are working together collaboratively to develop the computing resources needed. And when they look to satisfy their computing demand, because energy is so important and so intensive, they're trying to find a place in a location where there's cost-competitive energy. And they all have very much an environmental consciousness that drives them to look for environmentally sustainable energy resources. So in this area, it led them quickly to Holyoke. So we are working with that consortium right now to help them plan and develop that facility, which we expect to be online by the end of 2012.
Say exactly why this would be the natural place to site that data center.
Well, again, it's the low-cost, clean, renewable energy. The attractiveness of the cost-competitive energy is back to the future. You know, that's what started the whole economic engine here in Holyoke over 150 years ago. But now we couple that with a very robust fiber optic backbone network and network that connects the facility to any off-ramp that they want to get to. So, again, it's the abundance of cost-competitive clean energy and the abundance of fiber optic connectivity that Holyoke can offer this facility that attracted them to Holyoke.
In the last episode of Back to the Future, we heard about the extensive passenger rail network that used to extend from New Haven to Vermont from around the turn of the century to the 1920s. Plans were recently announced to revive that with a new high-speed intercity rail line to be opened on the west side of the Connecticut River. Holyoke will be a stop on that line. I asked Lavelle whether he could comment on what that might mean for Holyoke's future.
Yes, we were very excited to hear the news of the rail funding and the fact that Holyoke is on the map for a stop. And it plays a very vital role in the revitalization of the city. The city planning department right now has been at work for some time on developing a master plan for the redevelopment of the city and for redensifying the urban core. So as we've seen that the low-cost renewable energy and the connectivity availability in the city has attracted a certain level of investment already, we know that in order to leverage that for additional development, we're going to need those quality of life services like public transportation, restaurants, theaters, and all those other things to bring on more development. And so the rail plays a vital role in that whole plan.
So do you think that Holyoke can become a manufacturing center again in the lower carbon economy?
I think it can. Whether it will, I mean, you know, manufacturing in the United States in general is just difficult because it's not only an energy play that you have to be competitive against. It's the labor and several other pieces. So whether we become a manufacturing powerhouse again will be determined. But I think the energy is low-cost energy and low-cost renewable energy is going to be attractive to development in general. And so, you know, we may see more of an innovation economy and a technology economy first, and whether that spawns manufacturing as a follow-on to the ideas and concepts and developments that are created here, that would be even better.
A lot of people are thinking about relocalization, that if we get to the point of peak oil where fossil fuel is just going to be too expensive, that's going to be pulling back on the global economy. Can we reskill a labor force here that if we had a more locally based economy, that it could, in fact, make Holyoke a manufacturing center?
Absolutely. I think we can absolutely retool the factories and the workforce to become a manufacturing powerhouse. I mean, we are right now retaining in the area the high-skill precision manufacturing. And those machinists are highly skilled. And now it's a little bit lower skill level that would be required to do just general machining work. We have the skill base here in manufacturing. It's just using that base to apply it to a broader need. I think just in general, you're going back to the future concept directly applies to what's happening here. We're using the resources that generated the initial attraction for investment in the city and for creating the economy in the late 1800s. And we're at a point where revitalization is desperately needed in the city. And it's really the engine that's driving us through that revitalization right now.
Jim Lavelle of Holyoke Gas and Electric. We also heard from Penny Martorell, Charlie Lotsbeach, Bob Forent, and Calvin Ellis. Our series, Back to the Future, is funded in part by Mass Humanities, which receives support from the Massachusetts Cultural Council and is an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thanks for listening to Sea Change Radio. Check out the Back to the Future series webpage at seachange.net and search on Mass Humanities. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.